In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
Coming up is a podcast brought to you by the dedicated and diverse volunteers at 3CR. Just a quick message before you get there. For the month of June, we're asking listeners to donate to the station to help keep us going. We rely on the generous donations of the community to survive. Go to 3cr.org.au/donate and show your support for community-owned and community-run media. Thanks for your support and happy listening.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science. It is the show where you like to get lost, where you wander through the intellectual realms of the mindscape, the scientific mindscape, the universe of knowledge. And you know, you might not know exactly where you are or where you're going, but it's the journey, isn't it, rather than the destination. Does that sound fair, Linton?
Very fair, Chris. Yes, always wandering, always exploring, always journeying. That is the mission.
Science is about the journey, isn't it? I mean, it's about the process. It's about the discovery. It's about the stuff you do. It's not about the facts you find out. Not usually, but the facts are interesting too.
Couldn't have said it better, Chris. I couldn't have said it better. And that actually connects perfectly with who we've got on the show today. I'm taking over the microphone again for today's show, Chris. I hope you don't mind. Today we're going to be chatting with Ben Francis Shelley, who is a paleontologist who has kind of built his career as a paleontologist outreach expert in the cracks of his life. And today we're going to talk about his career and his journey to developing his own museum.
Oh.
Hmm.
I was going to say, like, paleontology outreach, like, talking to people about dinosaurs has got to be one of the easier jobs, surely, because everyone loves to hear about dinosaurs.
Loves to hear about dinosaurs, and people also love hearing about dinosaurs in their backyard. Yes.
I mean, you know, my backyard is pretty overgrown. I do need to do some gardening, but I doubt there are dinosaurs, apart from the feathered variety.
No, if you live down in the southeastern part of Melbourne, down the Bayside area, then your backyard, your coastal backyard, is an absolute hotspot of fossils. And Ben has, over the last 5 to 10 years, amassed a huge collection of these fossils. He's worked with citizen scientists, he's worked with community groups, he's worked with local councils, he's worked with motor yacht squadron organizations, and he now has a Bayside museum, a Bayside fossil museum. And so today we're talking about that whole process.
Oh, that's incredible. Yeah. I mean, and look, I'm dying to find out what kind of fossils he's got and, yeah, where we can see them. On with the show.
I think we're lost.
We're not lost.
Not even any short-range radio signals yet?
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
What so far?
Welcome back. You're listening to Lost in Science, and we're very lucky today to be joined by Ben Francis Shelley. Now, Ben's day job is a community climate action specialist with the Glen Eira City Council. But Ben, that's not what I've got you in here to talk about today. Thank you so much for coming along. Welcome to Lost in Science.
Oh, thank you, Lyndon. Yes, we're not going to be talking about my day job, as it were, as great as it is and all the work that I get to do in it, because there's another side of me. And like many researchers and scientists, we have many different sides to us, like a 20-sided dice, basically, if you can imagine rolling it.
We are multifaceted. Everyone's multifaceted, but maybe the facets of scientists tend to kind of come out at weirder angles. I'm curious to hear, though, how you got to where you are now.
Oh, I was all over the place. I kind of saw it and took it upon myself to be a jack of all trades. So I did a Bachelor of Environmental Science at Monash University. I did a stint at Sea Life Melbourne Aquarium in the Education and Curatorial Department for a little bit because I love marine life. My focus and my love has always been understanding how animals work from the inside out. So I was always really fascinated by anatomy and sea creatures and life in general, evolution. From there, I was able to get a role working at Museums Victoria as a paleontologist for several years, which was fantastic work. I got to work on whales and sharks and megafauna and prepare them and go out into the field and collect them. During COVID, though, the research funding basically completely stopped. So then I had to pivot and figure out what the hell am I going to do with my life from this point onwards if it's not involved in paleontology, because so much of my life was geared towards that already. I then worked at Zoos Victoria for a chunk of time. I then also started working at local councils, and I got a job at Whittlesea Council in the conservation team doing outreach and then also in sustainability as well. And then everything just... You know, I'm just holding on to the bull with the horns and as it was bucking me, basically, and holding on for dear life, hoping that I was going in the right direction. I've had more jobs than my parents have had in their entire career, and I'm 34 years old. So from there, I took on a job at Parks Victoria in communications, and it was also an outreach regarding conservation and science. And whilst that was happening, I got to get a curatorship with Bayside City Council and Bayside Gallery towards an exhibition called Prehistoric Bayside, which was focusing on the paleontology again. And that went really well. Everyone frothed over it. Everyone just loved fossils. And whilst that was happening, I changed roles again and did a community climate action specialist role at the City of Glen Eira and transitioned away from Parks Victoria to the local council again. And then this opportunity came up almost completely out of the blue. It was like in the last month that the exhibition was open for Prehistoric Bayside with Bayside City Council. And it was with the Beaumaris Motor Yacht Squadron. And they came in and they're like, Ben, you know that we've got space for this temporary exhibition setup that you've created for this fossil display. And I was like, that would be amazing. So holding on to the horns, I just basically went with the flow. It took about a year, but then I set up another space within the Yacht Squadron itself and called it basically the Prehistoric Bayside Museum. And everything just took hold of there. So it's been an incredible journey so far. I have no idea what I'm doing 100% of the time, and I'm just hoping for the best.
Well, you're holding on tight to the bull horns. That's one thing that you can say. And it sounds to me like all of the roles you've had have all been focused around connecting communities with their local environment, with local plants and animals, and ensuring people can enjoy and appreciate those. Do you think that would be one stream? Yeah. If you were to look back and think, actually, no, this isn't holding the bull by the horns. These are all strategic career moves.
When the opportunities come up, you've got to jump at them, right? So when those perfect jobs pop up, so I live in Glen Eira as an example. So when I saw a community climate action specialist, I was like, I love talking to the community. I like talking to people about what they can do about climate change. And even thinking about the paleontology work, it's talking about climate change and how the climate has changed. Even though it was 5 million years ago, we can use that as an example of what's happening today. So there's all these really lovely little segues that kind of meander into one another.
How was that shift from working with live creatures to working with creatures that were very, very extinct? You know, you say you were passionate about animals. How hard is it to go from looking at live whales or dolphins to looking at very, very extinct whales and dolphins?
It's actually so much easier than you could possibly imagine, because the living ones are squirming. They're moving around all the time. They're doing their own thing. And then when you've got a fossil in front of you, it's just a rock. You know, you can do anything that you want to the rock. And the most amazing thing about them is that you can hop particularly the Bayside fossil site, when you find them, the rocks are really robust. These things have been on the bottom of the seafloor for an extraordinary period of time. I've accidentally dropped a few fossils before, and you know, it comes off better against the floor, the fossil, half the time. It usually leaves a massive dent in it because it's just made of ironstone. So the transition at first was a little bit tricky. I had a really incredible part of my career where I was volunteering at Museums Victoria in the back of house area, and I basically got to go through all of the collections, as much of it as I possibly wanted, whenever I really wanted to. And it was something that nobody is really afforded to today. There's no real career where you can, or even volunteering opportunity where you can look at the back of house collections and just absorb the information as much as you possibly wanted. But when I was doing my undergrad, that was something I was constantly coming into contact with and picking up the fossils and figuring out what does, you know, whale bone look like if it's been broken in half. So understanding those different surfaces and also the density of the bone and all these other elements, understanding what whale ear bones look like, because they're arguably one of the most important fossils that we can find, because they tell us so much about what that individual whale was doing tens of millions of years ago. They look like, my favorite thing, there's, if you look at odontocete, periodics is what they're called. So toothed whale inner ear bones, they just look like three Maltesers that have melted together. They don't look like anything substantial, but they're all contorted in such a specific way that when you look at them, it can only belong to that one specific species. So it's like a fingerprint for understanding how those animals lived many millions of years ago. So getting that experience was something that was really formative and drove me to want to continue to do paleontology.
And was that interest in paleontology and animals grounded in the local geography, or was it anywhere and everywhere around the world? And then when you realized, hang on, a lot of these come from our backyard, that must have taken it to the next level.
You hit the nail on the head. When I first started looking into this kind of stuff, I was much, much younger. And the only things available in textbooks were from Eurasia and North America, and they're the really famous fossil sites. You can go to Wyoming and you can dig up a Stegosaurus, you know, or you can find Megalosaurus from the UK or something like that. But there was nothing really known about the fossil sites where I lived locally. The incredible thing is that they are amazing as well. There's so much out there. And I remembered I was there was a session with a local paleontologist when I was younger. And I would have been early 20s at the time. And I went, and he was basically telling me, look, the fossil sites of Beaumaris and Black, sorry, just Beaumaris at the time, were locally extinct. Like, there was basically nothing left to find. You know, there were small scraps of bone and the occasional shark tooth, but on the all, that wasn't yielding as much as it used to in the 1970s. And when you go down there and you physically start to look and you train yourself how to do it, I can go down to the fossil site right now and I could probably find about 50 to 60 shark teeth if I wanted to in my wetsuit. So it is an incredibly prolific fossil site.
Are we talking in the water? You have to go diving and snorkeling, or are we talking on the beach, up on the rocks?
So you don't need to go diving. I can certainly find fossil shark teeth at a low tide on the beach itself. But the most prolific areas are in the water, because no one's looking in the water. It's constantly getting churned around. The sand's moving all the time, so it's burying some of the fossils that were already previously loose. So it's a huge menagerie of different places to find fossils.
And what makes that area? So Beaumaris is sort of Melbourne's southeast,
about 30 to 40 minutes away from Melbourne.
What makes that area such a hotspot?
I have considered this for such a long time. And really, it's a really weird thing, because we do have a number of really fantastic fossil hotspots that are just not known about in the Bay at all. There's, like, for example, there's a fossil site at Curlewis that almost no one knows about, where you can find megalodon teeth. And it's just really hushed up, but people have been finding them for decades.
That's on the other side of Melbourne's Bay, isn't it?
Exactly right. So there's the Bellarine Peninsula, has a number of fossil sites. There's the Surf Coast that has an incredible fossil assemblage that's there as well. But Bayside is really unique because of the sheer amount of fossils that it's generating. It's tens of thousands every single year that are getting turfed up from the bottom of the sea floor. So I like to think of it as a bit of a Goldilocks effect. The conditions are just right. You've got the right geology, you've got the right fossils. The fossils are harder than the surrounding sediment that they're preserved in, and you're getting that active erosion that's ripping so many of these fossils from the layer naturally, and then they're pushing them up to shore. So you don't need anything other than your eyes in order to spot these fossils. You don't need tools to dig them out or anything. They are literally just waiting to be picked up on the shoreline.
Wow, that makes me want to finish this interview right now and go down to Beaumaris and have a look for myself. But
I think the conditions are pretty good today, for the record.
It must not be just you that knows about this, though. You say people aren't really exploring, but then that geologist that you spoke to a few years, you know, when you were younger, who said there's not as many as there used to be. Is there quite an active community down Bayside that are also interested in collecting these kinds of fossils? And what do you do? Do you have a responsibility to hand the fossils in, or to give them to someone, or share them with someone if and when you do find them?
Yeah, all really good questions. So I just refer to the first person, that old fuddy-duddy that basically told me that there weren't many fossils there before. He really just was not getting in the water and seeing just how much was actually coming out. So all of his reference articles and stuff were things that were based on land. So he'd only ever go for like maybe 30 minutes for a stroll. You need hours and hours to go and look for these fossils. And there's an incredible community of people. So when I started working at Museums Victoria, I would just bump into these people in the beach who would be looking for fossils for the first time and were really curious. And I'd say to them, hey, you know, I'm from, you know, the state repository. I'm really interested in collecting fossils so that we can research them for long term. I can teach you, if you'd like, about how to go about finding these fossils, but in the condition that if you do find something of scientific interest, you donate it to the museum. And soon enough, I started to get, you know, 15, 20 people, 30 people. There's so many people that are coming out of the woodwork that I've never met before, even to this day. Like that, I remember having those conversations in 2016 before I even started at the museum, and saying, look, I can teach you how to go about do this stuff. And now there's somebody in the water every single week, every couple of days. They're finding these incredible fossils. Like just recently, there was somebody who just sent me pictures of what appears to be a humerus from a very large penguin that probably stood more than a meter tall, which is intriguing because we only have little penguins alive today on the Australian continent. And we know that there were much, much bigger varieties that lived all across Australia, somewhere as tall as human beings, as little as 20 million years ago. So yeah, there's an incredible community that's there. And when they do find the fossils themselves, I say this to them, you have the responsibility. If you think it's, you know, scientifically valuable, they probably should go to the state museum. But one of the biggest issues with the state museum is that when the fossils went in there, nobody got the chance to see them other than researchers. They were hidden behind these massive shelving units. And it was very hard for people to interact and understand what was going on around the nature of where they were. So this, you know, museum initiative kind of came about a little bit because of that, because I wanted to show the public how many incredible things that we're finding at a breakneck pace all the time. It's just one fossil after the other. Like one of the little displays that I've got is just how many shark teeth I collected personally within a 2-day period, and there's more than 100, you know, just in this tiny little section of sharks and whales and other megafauna and a whole host of different things that we've been able to uncover, tusks of beaked whales, you know. So going through that, but also working with the museum. So the next open day that I have, I've invited the senior curator of vertebrate paleontology of the museum to come along and talk to the citizen scientists and have that engaged discussion about what they should be doing with those specimens.
You're listening to Lost in Science, where I'm chatting with Ben Francis Shelley about his development of Prehistoric Bayside, a museum dedicated to fossils in Melbourne's southeast. Can you tell us then about the process of starting your own museum? You said that there was an opportunity for a temporary exhibition, which you put together to sort of put on display some of the greatest finds that you had and other people's as well, I assume. And then your training working in the museum, were you able to put together the stories? Was it all you? Did you have a team? Do you have to apply? Do you need a museum license? Tell us what it means to start your own museum.
I look back on it and I'm like, it was just nuts. It has just been the busiest thing that I've ever had to do in my entire life, working, you know, at Glenara City Council and doing that kind of work and then doing this on the side as well. I have no time. Thank God I don't have kids, because if I did, there's no way I could ever accommodate the children as well as the museum as well.
You've got bony little toothy children.
Yeah, there's heaps. Then there's thousands of them. So it all started back in 2021 in the depths of lockdowns. Things were looking pretty miserable. I was looking for work at the time. I just left the museum because of a lack of funding, and I reached out to Bayside City Council, and particularly the Bayside Gallery, because I noticed that they had exhibitions. I had given talks to them previously and I had a little bit of a relationship there, and I said, hey, I've got this crazy idea. I still screenshot the email, and I use it in presentations whenever I talk about how I go about creating something like this. And I just sound like this kind of wheezy teenager, kind of like, hey, if you're really interested in like potentially doing something with a museum, I can create it for you, man, you know. And so They didn't get back to me in 3 months. But then I finally had a confirmation email that they had received the email, and they're like, hey, Ben, this is something we're interested in. Why don't you come in and just talk to us about what your idea is and put together a bit of a plan and we can see how it works. So I sat down with them, kind of spoke to them about my idea, got a floor plan from them to kind of give them an intention of where I would put some of the fossils and the signage and the different artwork that we could create together, and some rough assemblage of a budget. And we just basically went from there. I didn't hear from them for months at a time. And every time I would interact with them, they said, yeah, no, we are very interested. It just takes a really long time for these things to get approval in the first place. And having worked later on in a council, I can really appreciate that there are so many different approvals that you need to in order to spend money on certain things. And it took until 2023 to sign a contract with Bayside City Council for the temporary exhibition of 3 months called Prehistoric Bayside to be created. And then I said to them, if you want me to do this, I'm going to need a day a week. I'm going to need as much help as I possibly can. It's probably going to take about a year for me to be able to collect all of these fossils, not just mine and my own personal collection, because I had quite a large collection at the time, but also from this citizen scientists that I'd previously worked with, and then creating that signage and creating the artwork and everything else together. So it took ages. There was a documentary that we made about the megalodon as well. We translated it into Hindu at one stage, and that went really well for some reason. I have no idea why Indians were really, really keen in that documentary, but here we are. So and every single step has just been this, you know, again, I'm just like making it up as I go. I didn't know that I was going to be making a little documentary about the megalodon, but then it did. And then they had this huge viewing space where you could where I could showcase exactly what it was that we were doing. I collaborated with certain artists to create paleo artwork of these extinct animals. So one in particular, which is something I still use for the museum today, is of a giant type of bird called a pelagonithid, which is the largest flying bird that ever existed. But the thing that makes it really different is it has these bizarre pseudo teeth in the bill, unlike any living bird today. It looks like a dinosaur bird if you were to meld two different, completely different animals together. I know birds are dinosaurs, but they really do not look like a proper bird. And so creating that, and then creating the life-size artwork of a megalodon and giant killer sperm whales, and then hosting all the events for it. And so it got to, what was it, May of 2024, and it had the opening and everything went incredibly well. The events went incredibly well. I did an antiques roadshow styled event where people just brought fossils in and we just talked about them at the front, and it was so much fun. People were just, there were all these amazing fossils and like weird ear bones of things I'd never seen before, and we're just narrating and talking to people about it at the beginning.
Were they all amazing? Or I can imagine, you know, it sounds as though you've seen a lot of fossils. Do you get people coming up and saying, look, I found this, and you have to tell 5-year-old Timmy or 75-year-old Timmy, oh, nah, that's a rock? Are all fossils as equally interesting or as useful to research? Do you have to let people gently down sometimes?
Yeah, sometimes I look Timbo in the eyes and I go, Timmy, unfortunately, what you've got here is just a rock, but I can throw it away for you unless you'd like to keep this rock. We'll be on the beach together. And he's like, how would you throw it? I'd say I'd skip it on the surface of the water and go from there. But then there are the fossils that I am no longer interested in collecting because I've got too many of them. So whale ribs and vertebrae, they're humongous to take. And they're really, really difficult and bulky items. They fascinate most people because they're a fossil, but they don't have any real scientific value because they just represent part of the body that we already know. Like, we know that a whale exists there, but it can't tell us anything more about how that whale lived unless there's a shark bite or something like that on it. Mm. So there's plenty of fossils that I just leave behind to this very day every single time I go for a dive, or I might bring them back up onto shore and just chuck them on the beach for somebody to find at another time.
Whereas something like an ear bone, you said that can tell us a lot. Why can an ear bone tell us so much?
So it's all because of the position of the semicircular ear canals, the cochlear region, in respect to the rest of the ear bone itself. So whales are really weird. They've got two very dense ear bones. There's one called an external one, which is a tympanic bulla, and an internal one called a periotic, and they both are shaped completely differently depending on the species itself. So it's all based on the way in which the anatomy kind of cradles the ear bone in the back of the skull and how they kind of use it. So for an example, a blue whale's ear bone is gigantic. It's the size of two fists put together, and when you see it, there's no mistaking what it could possibly be. But when you look at for something like a southern right whale, they're still really big, but it's quite obviously very different from that of a blue whale, which belongs to the Rorqual family instead. So they all showcase that kind of vestige lineage of what kind of whale group that they belong to.
Ah, so their ear bones can give you some idea of the evolution of the species. And are you able to look at an ear bone fossil and get an estimate of how old that species might be or how old that fossil is? Or do you need extra equipment for that?
We do need extra equipment for it. We're very lucky in Bayside that the site as a whole has been roughly dated to about 5 to 6 million years of age, like almost the entirety of the strata. There are older segments to it that are probably between 10 and 12 million years of age. But on the all, if there's a little tiny bit of sediment that is still adhering to the fossil, we should be able to determine the rough age based on that. So if you know nothing about the site and you don't have any understanding of the geology or the animals that are coming out, it can be really hard to date a specimen. So just recently, there was a woman who came out to me and she said, I found these fossils in my grandparents' farm. I have no idea where they came from. And I was like, then I find it really difficult to age if you're not able to give me the locality details of where it's come from, because it could have come from halfway across the world. So there's all those considerations that you need to bring into account, dating the fossil and understanding the age and the stratigraphy of the surrounding sediment is a very important part of paleontology.
Mm. Well, I can also imagine, and coming back to your museum, so you did the temporary exhibition that finished up. Presumably your backyard and your back shed was full of life-size sculptures and structures.
It was very intense. I had to, the overflow went into Nonda's backyard, a little bit of it. So,
but then the Beau Morris Yacht Squadron said, we have some space and we'd love for you to use that space. Is that how it happened?
So I had a colleague of mine who reached out to the Yacht Squadron and was like, Ben, I'm going to set up a meeting between the Yacht Squadron and yourself. You have something here that I think would be of use to them. The Yacht Squadron, the Beau Morris Motor Yacht Squadron, is actually on the land where the fossil site is. It was constructed in the 1960s. So it would be the perfect place to talk about the fossils. It's not somewhere different. It's exactly where the fossil site is, and it's been there for the last 50 years. So to be able to talk about it at the venue would be something that's really special. And so they came in, I gave them a tour, I gave the Commodore and the Vice Commodore tours of the entire area and all the fossils that have been found in Beau Morris and in Black Rock as well. And they were like, wow, this is amazing. We'd love to have some of the material on display at the Yacht Squadron. And I said, great. Let's go. Let's do it. Let's see how we go about doing it. I look back at those words and I'm like, I had no idea how much time was going to be involved in creating a museum whatsoever. There was just an insane amount of effort that took place and money as well to actually throw the whole thing together and just hope for the best.
And now, what happens next with this collection that you have?
So Facebook Marketplace is an amazing repository of stuff that people are just looking to give away. So one of the first issue was that the cabinets did not belong to me. They belonged to Bayside City Council. So I had to find entirely new ones. And cabinets are expensive. I was looking at them newer for like $2,000 each and I wanted like six. And I was like, oh man, I'm gonna have to apply for grants and stuff. Luckily, Facebook Marketplace exists and jewelry stores, they go extinct every now and again. So I just waited until the right opportunity came. There was one jewelry store that basically closed and I got these fantastic cabinets for like $100 each. I was absolutely over the moon. They're very heavy. I put wheels on the bottom of them so that I could move them around. They all came with the affiliated locks and stuff and just started putting them in place and started figuring out how it should go. I had this huge plan of how everything was going to go and the kind of space that I would use for it. But as you started moving things in, you were like, actually, it doesn't feel right there. And it sounds like such a wanky thing to say, but the feng shui of the area was a really important thing, how people were going to be moving around. So there were multiple iterations of what the museum looked like and where we were putting cabinets. And because everything was on wheels, it just made everything 10,000 times easier. I'm so glad I went to Bunnings and I got those wheels to put on the bottom of those cabinets because they weigh a ton. And then you put all the fossils in there that weigh so much. Like, it's like unbelievable. So I've at a stage now where We have over 1,000 fossils that we basically have within the cabinets and in the central section where we have the citizen scientists that are also discussing things as well. And it's incredible to see the momentum it's also taken. So what I've decided to do moving forward with it, because we have to pack it down to a certain extent to keep it safe as well, is to have these open days. And so we hope to have as many open days as we possibly can. The next one is on June 27th. But people froth on them. They absolutely love them. I advertised it for like less than 3 hours and it completely sold out all 350 tickets immediately. So I was blown away by it. And so with each of the open days that we plan on doing, we'll have a different theme. So the next one, unfortunately, which is booked out, but you can go on the wait list, is going to be all about sharks. I've got Professor John Long from Flinders University, a world-renowned shark and fish expert who's going to come and talk about fishes, sharks, and their evolution. When he was younger, he actually found fossils with his cousin Tim Flannery from Beaumaris. And then I'm going to be giving a talk about the evolution of the megalodon and its demise as well, and looking at the newest evidence that we found from the citizen scientists, but also having that on display so that people can see it. You know, we've got giant whale ribs, vertebrae, which are half the size of me, that are way more than 30 kilos. They're so heavy. We find them at the bottom of the sea floor. And we take the video footage of how we go about finding it as well. So there's TVs all over the place showcasing exactly how we go about finding these fossils and how people can find fossils without having to use tools as well. So it's really grown into something else, and the momentum is just awesome.
Why do you think fossils excite people so much?
I think of my younger self. So if I travel back in time and I go say the same question to 10-year-old Ben, he'd just say, because they're just so amazing. Like the thought of a Tyrannosaurus Rex is insane. You know, an animal, a predator that is bigger than an African bush elephant that could leer into a two-story window with teeth the size of bananas. You can't even make that up in a fantasy film or something. It's just insane. And then you start looking at some of the animals that used to exist in prehistoric Bayside, for example. You look at the giant killer sperm whale, Leviathan, 17 and a half meters in length, the biggest functional teeth ever found in the fossil record, more than 30 centimeters long. It had 40 of them studded in its jaws, arguably one of the strongest bite forces ever recorded in the animal kingdom. This was a predator that was quite possibly one of the biggest predators, macro predators, that ever existed in the history of the world. And we have the last remains of this creature on our doorstep, just 20 minutes away from where I live.
God, it's incredible to think of what we've shared this world with, isn't it? And to be able to hold a piece of that in your hand does something very special. Is that an aspect of the museum too? It's not just very heavy, heavy cabinets. Is there a touch and feel element too? And you said you had citizen science volunteers or other people contributing to help share this love and this passion that you have.
Yeah, look, I had a request from Jimmy, who's 13 years old, if he could be part of the citizen science table because of the things that he's found just within the last 6 months. And I was like, absolutely, you are totally there. You can talk to people. You know more about fossils than I would say 99% of the population does. And, you know, his ability to be able to find really important things. He's been able to find some amazing looking shark teeth just recently. So they're all considerations. There's all these amazing people that come together. There is a tactile element that I always wanted to introduce that I wasn't able to do for the original exhibition. So I just on the onset, I love hard rubbish. I think it's fantastic. You can make some amazing finds with hard rubbish. And a colleague of mine came to the office with about 15 kilos of ether foam, which is this museum grade material that you can make mounts out of. And I was like, why? Where did you find this? This is incredible. She's like, you can have it all. Go nuts. She found it on the side of the road. There was a gallery that would just basically thrown it out. It was about to go to landfill. And I was like, great, I will take this hundreds of dollars worth of ether foam off your hands and I'll create these little mounts where people can actually can put the fossil in so that they're stabilized and people can touch and feel the individual fossils. So there's the back end of whale skulls, there's shark teeth that they can touch, there's ribs, there's everything that you can possibly imagine. So that I was able to introduce that tactile element because it's a really important part of what people want to see. It's a tricky combination. You know, you've got fossils that are millions of years of age and you want people to interact with them, but you're also aware that people can break things, you know, and they have a tendency, they won't mean to, but they can very easily drop that giant megalodon tooth that you've got on display. So there are some that are definitely going to be behind cabinets. And then there are others where I'd say to people, you're welcome to pick that up. You can actually touch and feel that and there's no problem at all.
Where would you like the museum to be in 5 years? I don't mean physically. I mean, what would a dream be? Is this something in your ideal world that you'd be doing full time?
It would be great to be able to do it full time. There's just so much work and there's so many extra things that I would really want to add to it. So I can give you an idea of just two pieces of work that I've been putting on the back of the in the background. So another piece of hard rubbish that I found in Caulfield was this light box with a really, it had a quite incredible depth to the box and a glass lid. And I was like, great, I can create a display from this. These are valuable, you know, they're worth hundreds of dollars, these boxes that people are just throwing away on the side of the road. I can create an installation where it looks like you're looking at the bottom of the seafloor and you're hiding all the fossils and the individual bits of things that would you'd otherwise see if you were out looking for fossils. I still haven't figured out the signage. I'm just paint, like tonight I'm going to go put the third coating of paint on it. So I'm still in the process of creating it and figuring out what I should put into it and how heavy it's going to be and where it should go in the museum. But there's so much work. There is lifetimes of work when it comes to looking at the fossil site, just at Beaumaris itself, not alone. Like there's a second fossil site that we discovered in 2018 called Black Rock, and it's underwater and it's amazing. And there's all these fossils that you can find. You can devote your entire life 10 times over just to look for the fossils and then prepare the fossils and curate the fossils and then to put them on display and create signage and everything else. You know, there was one stage where we were leading up into the first open day of November last year where I was pushing maybe 14-hour days, just getting up, doing the work that I needed to do for Glenara, enjoying that, don't get me wrong. But then after work, just going into the yacht squadron and just working until like 11, 12 o'clock at night and then coming home and just getting it done because I just didn't have the time for it. And so many weekends that have been devoted to doing it just so that I can get it across the line. But now it's there. And I guess my hope for it is that it would get bigger, that I don't know how it would get bigger, but you know, one really nice thing was libraries have contacted me recently from certain councils and have asked if I can display specimens in there as well. So I'd love the opportunity to spread out and have lots of little micro museums all over the place. And if the opportunity ever comes up to have a bigger, more permanent museum, then it's something I would certainly look at, but it would require some serious funding behind it in order to do that too.
If people want to engage with the museum, where's the best place to find it?
It's the socials. As much as I hate Mark Zuckerberg and his control of Meta and the Meta universe, it's still a really great way to communicate to people. And so if you're interested in anything about Prehistoric Bayside, all you've got to do is just look, you can look it up on Instagram or on Facebook. It's just Prehistoric Bayside or on Instagram, Prehistoric_Bayside. And you can find us and you can follow us and you can keep in tune with all the recent developments, when the next open day is going to be, the new discoveries that we're making. Earlier in the year, as an example, Ryan Langdenfeld, one of the citizen scientists, he called me up and he's like, Ben, what are you doing after work today? And I was like, probably going to the beach, depending on what you say. I found this 2-foot-long oblong thing on the bottom of the seafloor that's loose. It's really heavy and I'm going to need some help to lift it off the bottom of the seafloor. And I was like, okay, cool. That what you're describing sounds like a giant portion of jaw, probably from a baleen whale. Let's go and inspect it. Went down to the beach, retrieved this gigantic hunk of jaw. The jaw itself is like half the size of me, but it probably would have come from an animal that had a jaw 4.5 to 5 meters in length. So just huge animal when you really consider it. The rest of it was nowhere to be seen. It was just that tiny fragment of a much, much bigger chunk. So it's part of the displays that we've got for the Prehistoric Bayside area.
It's wonderful to have someone in the community so passionate about engaging with the world around them and sharing that with other people. Thank you so much for joining us today on Lost in Science, Ben.
Thank you so much, Lyndon. It's been a pleasure.
3CR celebrating 50 years.
Did you enjoy listening to that podcast?
3CR is a community radio station, and you, the listener, are a part of that community. Right now, it's our radiothon. We need you to pitch in with a few dollars to keep the station going. We can't do it without you. It's easy. Head to 3cr.org.au/donate. Your donations really matter.